We've discussed the rise of authoritarianism a lot on this podcast, the global challenge to democracy coming from nationalist leaders. But we haven't broached what we'll be talking about on this episode, as the world needs more cooperation, not less, especially in relation to climate change. We ask, is an ethical foreign policy still possible? And what should our terms of engagement be with governments that we disagree with? Are democratic states getting this balance right, or are they getting it wrong?
The breaking news is the far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro has won Brazil's presidential race.
Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
What he did today is straight out of a dictator's playbook.
If Donald Trump is reelected, all the progress we have made will be in jeopardy.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Today, we're joined by Mary Caldor, Emeritus Professor of Global Governance at the London School of Economics, author of numerous books, including The Pathbreaking New Wars, and a leading member of Another Europe is Possible. In the 1990s, she advised Robin Cook, the late Labour Party Foreign Secretary, who famously resigned over opposition to the Iraq War, on what an ethical foreign policy should look like. Today we'll pick her brains on how the rise of authoritarianism globally impacts this kind of vision, asking if an ethical foreign policy is still possible in this increasingly authoritarian world. As usual, you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. An extended version of this pod is available to members of Another Europe is Possible, the campaign group that acts as the home of the European left in Britain. By joining us, you participate in our movement-building efforts to confront injustice and promote grassroots internationalism. To join, support our work, and gain access to an extended version of this podcast, go to anothereurope.org/join.
Hi, Mary, welcome to the show. Let's leap straight in. You were an advisor to Robin Cook when he was Foreign Secretary. What did you and Cook mean by the idea of an ethical foreign policy?
I think absolutely key to an ethical foreign policy was the notion of human rights. And that's what represented, I think, a break with the past. It's actually not true that we didn't have a rules-based system or a multilateral system. It's just that after 1989, we stopped agreeing about the rules. Before 1989, the rules were very much couched around the classic laws of war. The key feature of the system was, when is it right or legal to use military force in international affairs? And the system of international law was very much based on laws of war, which actually tell you when the use of military force is legal. And the conditions for the legality of military force very much had to do with the issue of self-defense and collective defense. So during the Cold War period, non-interference in internal affairs was widely agreed, as was territorial integrity. And even if horrible human rights abuses were going on, there was a general agreement that you should not intervene in internal affairs. And actually, during the Cold War period, there were three sorts of cases in which they were really humanitarian intervention, but they were always presented as something different. One was the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia, which got rid of the Khmer Rouge. One was the Tanzanian invasion of Uganda, which got rid of Idi Amin. And one was the Indian war with Pakistan over the independence of Bangladesh. And, you know, Nicholas Wheeler's written a really good book about this, showing how the debates in the Security Council, they tried to couch everything, not in terms of basic human rights and human values, but in terms of collective national self-defense. And I think what happened even before the end of the Cold War was that a whole new generation of legal instruments started to be developed after the end of the Second World War that emphasized human rights, the conventions on human rights, the Helsinki Agreement of 1975. These were really new. And they got meaning because civil society took them seriously. They got meaning because there was huge support from the peace movement and others for human rights in Eastern Europe and from campaigning groups in America for the rights of Latin Americans living under military dictatorships. And so in a way, the sort of discourse of the 1990s, which was encapsulated in the ethical foreign policy, was all about human rights. Yes, it was about a liberal world order and multilateralism, but it was about a rules-based system in which human rights were central.
So how do you get from there to the Iraq War? I mean, what went wrong? And do you feel like that human rights discourse kind of facilitated things going wrong?
I don't honestly think that the human rights discourse facilitated things going wrong, but there's no question that the human rights discourse led to the Kosovo War. Absolutely key in the whole, going back to your first question on ethical foreign policy, absolutely key to the whole story was what happened in Bosnia. And the sense that there was once again a genocide happening on European soil and we weren't doing anything about it. And there was huge pressure from civil society to do something about it, which actually did lead to a whole lot of innovations that weren't terribly effective, like safe havens, humanitarian corridors, but most importantly, the criminal tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which included crimes against humanity. Now, people say this isn't new. We had the Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials. But in those trials, the central issue were crimes of war. Hitler was being tried for aggression. And actually, the Holocaust at that time was not nearly as significant as the crime of starting a war, which was very much part of the rules-based system at that time. So what was new about the Yugoslav and the Sierra Leone tribunals and subsequently the International Criminal Court was this emphasis on crimes against humanity. And going back to the ethical foreign policy, I mean, what the Labour government did in 1997 was actually to arrest war criminals and to arrest Pinochet, which was a huge break with the past. So that's part of the story of the ethical foreign policy. When Kosovo came along, everybody felt there was a real need to stop the ethnic cleansing of Albanians. Serbs were trying to get rid of Albanians from this province of Serbia. And already 230,000 had been expelled from the province before the war began. And there was a determination to stop ethnic cleansing. But the huge problem of Kosovo was that actually, the means were completely inappropriate. And I don't think anybody had really thought about that. Somehow military force was a black box. And when you couldn't do something, you use military force and hey, presto, you get a solution. But actually what happened was they'd used the tool of bombing and Milosevic speeded up ethnic cleansing under the cover of the bombing. They relied on rather unsavory militias on the ground. And there was a lot of collateral damage. I mean, I still think it was probably the right thing to do because in the end, the Albanians, an extra 800,000 were expelled during the war and they all got to return to their homes. But I think it raised huge questions about how you do this kind of thing. Now, Blair was absolutely triumphant. When he went to Kosovo, he was greeted by cheering Kosovars. And so I do think that was a factor in the Iraq War. But if I think about why the Iraq War happened, it wasn't because of the new doctrine of military intervention. The Iraq War happened because there was blowback by the American right, and particularly by these terrible neoconservatives that came out of the military-industrial complex, that by then was a sort of complex involving a UK military-industrial complex, the Israeli military-industrial complex, and they wanted to do unfinished business that they failed to finish in the 1991 Iraq War. It had absolutely nothing to do with humanitarianism. It had to do with their concerns that the whole edifice of the military-industrial complex was no longer relevant. Of course, they had 2001, and if Robin Cook had been in power, if Al Gore had won the election, we would have said 2001, the attack on the Twin Towers, was a crime against humanity, not an act of war. It was carried out by a group of terrorists, not a foreign state, but they chose to interpret it as an act of war. And it was because they chose to interpret it as an act of war that they went to war in Afghanistan. They said it was a war in self-defense. And it's interesting, and it relates to this argument about a rules-based system. It's actually very important for them to use legalistic language too. So they said that they'd gone to war in Afghanistan in self-defense. They used this curious justification for the war in Iraq as anticipatory self-defense, which is completely unjustifiable because you're not allowed to go to war according to international law and according to the famous letter that the US exchange of letters between the British and the Americans during the American War of Independence. You're not allowed to use anticipation unless the threat is instant and overwhelming. And undoubtedly, the threat was not instant and overwhelming. But they needed legalistic language. It's exactly the same with the drone campaign. I mean, the whole point about international law is, as I said, it legitimizes war. It tells you when it's legal to go to war, and it tells you how it's legal. And what's legal in war is to kill combatants. Basically, the international laws of war legitimize the killing of combatants. And so that's how they justify the drone campaign. This is a war against terror, and we're killing combatants. Whereas anybody else would call it targeted assassination. It's not a battle against a foreign army. And similarly, oh, you can go through all of this, but the point really that I'm making is that it's about how you interpret the international law. So to what extent did Kosovo contribute to all of this? I think it did in the sense that maybe Tony Blair thought that he would do the same thing in Iraq as he'd done in Kosovo, that he was drunk on the success of the Kosovo intervention and thought he'd be greeted by cheering Iraqis. Although I do think that his main motivation was that he was very much believed in power and thought he should go along on a special relationship and believed he should support Bush. So I think it's a tragedy, actually, that people think that Kosovo contributed to Iraq, because I think there's a real need to rethink humanitarian intervention, but to think about it in a different way. Of course, there was, after Kosovo, there was the Kosovo Commission, of which I was a member, which concluded that the war in Kosovo was legitimate but illegal, and that there needed to be a revision of international law. And then there was the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Independence that was sponsored by the Canadian government that came up with the concept of responsibility to protect. And again, the problem with responsibility to protect was exactly the same as the problem of humanitarian intervention. Nobody discussed the means. You simply can't use classic military force, which is designed for fighting battles against a similar enemy, to protect ordinary people, unarmed civilians on the ground. It just doesn't work. And the first time responsibility to protect was used was Libya. And the experience of Libya was extremely similar to the experience of Kosovo. So the idea was to stop Gaddafi using his heavy weapons against those people who declared independence in eastern Libya, in Benghazi. And the task was given to NATO. And of course, the only thing NATO can think of is airstrikes. So they used airstrikes. And undoubtedly, they did bomb all of Gaddafi's heavy weaponry, which explains why overall casualties in Libya are a lot lower than casualties in Syria. But at the same time, they empowered all these armed militias on the ground, just like in Kosovo, and made a long-term political solution impossible.
I think one of the themes running through this so far, which, you know, might be notable to listeners, is actually you can make a really strong argument that the construction of a rules-based system about global conflict isn't something that was historically a product of the West then imposed on the rest of the world. I really like your description of the three classic Cold War case studies, Uganda, Cambodia, and Bangladeshi independence, as demonstrating actually that the idea of responsibility to protect, which actually runs through into the first decade of this century, when responsibility to protect becomes this international norm, wasn't really of particular Western providence, but was an attempt by numerous states globally to try to construct a humanitarian approach to international human rights. And what was interesting in that context with responsibility to protect at the United Nations, I think I'm right in saying this, and you will disagree with me if necessary, is that actually the Bush administration weren't particularly interested in it because they had all of these other, often quite absurd, as you have outlined, legal justifications for the Iraq war that didn't really fully fit with the responsibility to protect a narrative at all. And, you know, another, you know, crazy sort of argument from that period of American history was the one put forward by James Torture Memos U, where they constructed this legal justification for torturing foreign nationals by the American state. So this was an administration that was completely committed to both American unilateralism and a rejection, effectively, of a human rights agenda. Now, Cook, I think, clearly understood this when he resigned over the Iraq war. And in his resignation speech in the House of Commons, he talked about the importance of a world order governed by rules of multilateralism.
Our interests are best protected not by unilateral action, but by multilateral agreement and a world order governed by rules.
I guess my question is to bring this forward to the present day. How does that world order governed by multilateralism work if authoritarian leaders increasingly don't follow rules and maybe they openly reject the idea of human rights and see, as Trump certainly does, international politics as an exercise in raw power? Where does that leave, like, rules-based multilateralism? Because it presumably makes it much harder. And how exactly would pro-democrats approach that at the current time? You know, what would an ethical foreign policy look like in a world where there's so many states who don't really want to observe the same rules and actually always want to give themselves an exception from a human rights approach?
Well, first of all, I want to emphasize that I don't think it's just about a rules-based system. It's about a human rights-based rules-based system. Because actually we've had long periods of peace in history where there has been a degree of multilateralism and a degree of agreed rules, you know, whether we're talking about the concert of Europe in the 19th century or the post-Cold War sort of bipolar world order, there was an implicit agreement on the rules. And the rules that were important, as I said before, were things like territorial integrity and non-interference. I think what's happened is the rules no longer fit the contemporary world. They just don't work. And particularly in a world of what I call new wars, the rules were very much built around old wars, traditional wars between states where you could assume that states were responsible. And the result is that different groups of people have either interpreted the rules in the wrong way, or, you know, they've chosen their own forms of interpretation. I can't even say the wrong way, because actually it's all about, you know, groups of people agreeing on the rules. And the truth is nobody agrees on the rules any longer. So that is, I think, the big problem that we face today. We live in a world without rules because different people have different ideas about what are the appropriate rules. And what we need is an agreement on a human rights rules-based system. Actually, a lot of the populist dictators do, in fact, you know, I mentioned Bush and his legalistic interpretations. It's incredible the lengths Putin goes to He even uses terms like responsibility to protect and human security. He used that in the war with Georgia over Ossetia. And in the case of Ukraine, he talks about saving Russian nationals. And equally, Xi Jinping actually talks about human rights and human security. And for him, human rights are economic and social rights and not political rights. So they all kind of use legalistic language in their own interests. And the question then, of course, is there's the whole story of raw power and realism and what are they doing? I mean, whose interests are they talking about? Because there are many realists today, John Mearsheimer, for example, in Chicago, who would argue that actually the kind of behavior that Trump is indulging in isn't in the interests of the United States, it's in the interests of particular little groups. But I think what is the case is that the rise of authoritarianism has somehow accentuated these huge disagreements about the rules.
So, Luke, why has there been so much attention, in your view, on China in relation to human rights? How big a factor is China in the authoritarian turn globally?
I think it's big. I think especially in the UK and maybe in Europe more broadly, I mean, so much of our attention is put so strongly on what's happening in the United States and the Trump administration. And we'll go on to talk about that later. Clearly, the November 3rd elections are a hugely important moment for global democracy and for international human rights. So I think that's understandable. You know, the United States is a historic ally of Britain and the European Union. So, you know, clearly our attention is always moved in that direction. But I think since Xi Jinping took power in China in 2012, the lurch that his regime has undertaken towards increasingly intensive authoritarianism in a number of different areas is a hugely big deal because China is the rising power. It's the new industrial powerhouse of the global economy. So what's happening domestically in China is really important because China is so powerful and it has this, you know, major industrial economy now. And if you look at things like the terrifyingly totalitarian social credit system that listeners might have heard of, which takes the very capitalist idea that credit ratings agency, so can you afford to pay back your loan, and tries to extend this to regulating the social behaviours of citizens. So China takes something like that that we're really familiar with, and it says, well, hang on a minute, trust is about how good a citizen you are, your general trustworthiness. And this could be anything from being rated down for not cleaning up after your dog or for playing music loudly or, at the most ominous level, speaking out against the Chinese regime. So it has this super authoritarian implication. And then coupled with that, Xi Jinping is very much committed to the idea that 2008 financial crisis was a real pivot moment in global history where it was characterized by the rise of China and the fall of the United States. And that means in Hong Kong, it means in Xinjiang, and it means in Taiwan, China will now assert its interests much more aggressively. So Hong Kong democracy closed down. Uyghur people in Xinjiang held in these appalling re-education camps that 1.5 million people of the Uyghur ethnic descent held in those camps in really horrible conditions to say, well, look, now you need to learn your loyalty to the Chinese state. So it is a huge shift to authoritarianism that maybe doesn't directly relate to the broader rise of authoritarianism globally, or at least it has very specific causes that are unique to China. But I think just having such an increasingly strong and confident global power pursuing this very dictatorial politics clearly hugely challenges democracy internationally.
So, Mary, does China illustrate some of the problems of how to be a democrat in an authoritarian world? I mean, if you take climate change as the core example, you have to work with China, and China actually can make a case for itself as a kind of leading combater of climate change. But does that mean there are limits to how far you can take sanctions over human rights abuses? And were sanctions ever the answer in the first place?
But I think generalized sanctions are never the answer, because they're a little bit like the use of military force. They're blaming the whole population for their leaders. And as we've seen in places like Yugoslavia or Iraq, generalized sanctions actually lead to corruption, criminality, and the people who benefit are the elite. But nobody is really talking very much about generalized sanctions. But I think there can be a case for targeted sanctions. There can be a case for tracing the assets of some of the key members of the elite, because these are kind of oligarchical systems. I mean, maybe China's not quite the same as, say, the United States or Russia or India, where you've really got systemic corruption and people are trying to be in power in order to get money. And there's very little sort of public functions happening. So you get this kind of, in a way, circular system in which oligarchs, and it's very much related to systems which are based on elections, because you win elections by getting lots of money from the oligarchs, and then you give the oligarchs money once you get into power. So China's not like that. I think the absolute key to dealing with authoritarian regimes, and that's really learning from the experience of Eastern Europe and Latin America, is civil society and civil society solidarity. It's terribly complex how you engage with authoritarian leaders. But what's really important is to discuss and engage, particularly with critical intellectuals in places like China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and have real discussions about what the best strategy is. There are some strategies where engagement really opens up space and can be very positive. There are other strategies where engagement legitimizes authoritarian practices. And trying to find that balance, trying to create that civil society space, for me is absolutely key. And that's why, going back to your original question, thinking about an ethical foreign policy is not just about the fundamental principles. You know, what are the concepts? So rules-based system, multilateralism, human rights. But also, how do you do it? It's not the classic state-to-state diplomacy. It has to be much more grounded in an understanding of politics all over the world and an understanding of civil society links and so on and so forth. So it requires really a new kind of diplomacy, a new kind of intelligence, which instead of the classical top-down intelligence based on spies, you actually want really to understand social and political developments in the countries that you're concerned about.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Civil society movements, they're always seen as a kind of soft, fluffy end of anything, but they are also the only things that bring about lasting change.
Exactly. And they're the only people that represent values. I mean, my argument is, even if there's only one person protesting Xi Jinping, you should be supporting that person just for the sake of that person. But actually, that kind of support does generate wider support and does generate movements and does represent a whole different way of thinking. Because in the end, what we're trying to do is to change thinking.
Yeah. And do you think we're nudging towards that? I mean, I know a lot of international networks have been built around the Hong Kong protest movement.
It's incredibly disappointing how little we're doing. And I've been thinking about that because it's so much easier now. I've been just having Zoom meetings over the past week with people in Armenia and Azerbaijan, civil society people. But actually, you can do so much more of that nowadays with the internet. And yet, I have the feeling that the kind of international solidarity that really produced a change of discourse in Latin America and Eastern Europe doesn't really exist. I mean, we should all be persuading, or we're not necessarily persuading, but we should be getting dozens of people to go across and sort of meet people in Belarus and think about how to support them and engage in a discussion about how to get rid of Lukashenko, and not just Hong Kong. It's really fascinating, the article in The Observer on Sunday about the Milk Tree Alliance between Thailand, Taiwan and Hong Kong, and how they're exchanging and talking to each other. I think that's really, really important. important.
Do you think that there are other aspects of what you might call globalization that are sort of helpful? I mean, it's very easy to get caught up into the horror of global authoritarianism in 2020. But maybe if we're trying to be positive, you know, there are some things that are just maybe the way in which modern sociology has changed that links to your argument about new and old wars that makes the cost calculation of conflict very different to past moments of great power conflict in history. I was reading recently about this very sort of mainstream strategic studies style argument about Taiwan, but it was making quite a persuasive case that Taiwan could militarily defeat a Chinese invasion because of the sheer logistics of bringing 500,000, a million Chinese troops into the Taiwanese Straits and all the preparation that that would involve. And so they would be able to flood the Taiwanese with mines and close down economic interaction with Beijing and with mainland China. So itself producing a crisis, which is illustrating, I guess, the way in which the Taiwanese, Chinese and American economies are linked in this interconnected way. So, you know, if you're looking at it quote-unquote rationally, China doesn't have much of an incentive to go to war in Taiwan. It just doesn't really look like it would fit for China because it could create this extraordinary crisis. Whereas 100 years ago, I think the calculation may well have been very different. What do you think?
I agree with that. And actually, I think the term globalization is a sort of misnomer because I think right from the beginning of capitalism, from the late 18th century, capital was global. But what I think has changed is that international world order was determined largely by military force in the past, and that's no longer possible. And after the Cold War, it became apparent that that was no longer possible, and suddenly globalization became the new fashionable term. So my feeling is the term globalization has become important just because what I call old war is no longer feasible. Well, what do I mean by the fact that it's no longer feasible? There's a wonderful passage by Engels in the 19th century where he said there will come a time when the smallest gunboat will be able to defeat the largest warships. And actually, that time has come. Actually, the technology that militias have access to, they have what I call vernacular technology. They have explosives that they can make at home with detergents and fertilizers, but they can use mobile phones to trigger them. They can easily defeat major tanks. And it's really hard to win nowadays with military force. I mean, you gave the example of Taiwan. My example is the bombing of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. In order to defeat ISIS, they actually had to destroy completely the whole place. Mosul and Raqqa are reduced to total rubble. Nobody in those areas supports the war against ISIS. Although they hated ISIS, at least they weren't all killed or expelled from their homes by ISIS. And the terrible thing is that after all that time, ISIS is reappearing in the areas that were supposedly liberated by, I don't know, the 50 countries in the anti-ISIS American coalition. So war can be terribly destructive of the classic kind, but it can't be effective. And one can only hope people will be rational to realize that it can't be effective. And actually what you get, I mean, Iraq war was another example. Yeah, it was fairly easy to invade Iraq. And, you know, in that clip of Robin Cook, he pointed out that they were actually very weak now. So the Americans could just walk into Iraq. But as soon as an insurgency started, actually all they controlled was their military bases. And it has gone on for years and years and years. And what you get instead is what I call a new war, which is lots of different local militias operating all over the place, looting and pillaging, fomenting extremist ideologies. Now, a very interesting feature of all this is that the Russians have understood this. And they have this concept of non-linear war. And the idea of non-linear war is that you deliberately produce new wars. You deliberately destabilize countries. There's an absolutely amazing article by Gerasimov, who is the chief of staff of the Russian armed forces, explaining how easy it is to destabilize a country simply by sending in special forces, using what they call political technology, by which they mean interference in elections and cyber attacks and so on. And that's what they did in Ukraine. And it's very easy to do destabilization. But the question is, how do you solve the problem after that? It would be very frightening if that's what the Chinese lesson was, that maybe they can do nonlinear war instead of classic war, because that would have alarming consequences for places like Taiwan or Hong Kong. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right that actually the big difference now is that it's really difficult to use classic military force to win objectives. And the question is to win what the traditional realists call compellence. I mean, the Americans haven't been able to compel anybody to fulfill their will with their military force. The main purpose of military force has actually been to affect American domestic politics, not to influence international geopolitics. And so I think you're absolutely right. That's ruled out. And that's where the opportunity for civil society arises. The danger is that you can still do lots of destruction and destabilization.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this pod is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we discuss the upcoming American elections and exchange some predictions. Dangerous territory indeed. It's a good chat. If you do want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. You can join us at anothereurope.org/join. Doesn't cost much at all, and it really does make a big difference to our ability to produce podcasts like this one.
So I'm going to kick off with my prediction about the US presidential election, not with a prediction, just with an observation, which was that everybody on Twitter yesterday was saying, should we put a bet on the Democrats taking Texas? Or is that just, you know, are we just drinking their Kool-Aid? And I know how betting works and everything, and how, you know, the more people, however crazy you are, if you bet on something, then the odds go down. But the odds now on Biden winning in Texas are 9-4. It's just incredible. So I do think Biden's going to win. And the thing I'm enjoying most about it is that I don't think that our conservative government really entertained that possibility until yesterday.
That's interesting. There's also a huge number of people who are voting early. The Guardian reported that 40% of electorally registered voters in Florida have already cast their ballots, and Biden currently has a 7% lead. Now, that sounds very, very reassuring, because Trump absolutely has to win Florida. It's the classic swing state. But there is also this tendency and expectation that Democratic voters are more likely to vote early. I think Texas is clearly becoming very close and has been getting closer over a longer term period because of demographic change. I think Texas is probably still out of reach. But as Cass Muda said on the podcast we did not so long ago, you know, the really big question is how successful the Republicans will be in suppressing the vote. So what is the status of the mail-in ballots going to be? Will it end up in the Supreme Court? Will Trump accept the result? Because I think you're right that if it's a fair election, Biden's going to win. That all of the data we have available shows that Biden has a really big lead. But if the margins are still tight enough in some of those swing states, that if you can knock 5%, 7% of votes off that are mostly Democrat, then you could put them in reach for the Republicans still. So I think we're still in a very kind of contested moment for American democracy, for sure.
I agree with that completely. But I think my worry is that I think it's very likely that Biden will win. But actually, how will he deal with the social monster that Trump has created. I mean, there are 30 million Trump supporters and most of them are armed. And so my concern is, are we going to get a really violent reaction to all this? And will we get areas of America that are very similar to the kind of new wars that I talk about?
I think that's the other side of this as well, isn't it? That, you know, lots of the politics that you've been analysing for many years, Mary, in maybe the global south, to use that phrase, the maybe the best available phrase of a series of inadequate descriptions, but the politics of, say, rentier capitalism, politics as deal-making, as corrupt factions that you often find in countries that are experiencing organized violence, violent conflict. Actually, now those politics very much are rooted in how Trump has approached politics in the United States. It's a series of deals in which you buy off different groups. So, you know, you'd buy off the Pentecostals with your Supreme Court appointments and your broader judicial appointments, and you have that alliance with the Christian right. You have another alliance with Wall Street and big capital through extraordinary tax cuts, and your foreign policy in turn is just a series of deals in which there is no principle involved. There's just, well, what can I get out of it for myself? And then there's also, well, what can I get out of it for myself, i.e. the Trump family and my direct economic interests, and how can I leverage that from the White House? Which, again, I think that's a pretty new thing for an American president. I don't think we had that kind of phenomenon with the George Bush Jr. presidency, for example, even though that's a big American political dynasty.
I think there were elements, you know. I think there were elements through the military-industrial complex. You know, there was always pork barrel politics around the defense industry. And to me, that's really an interesting feature of the whole thing, because basically the sort of state-run systems, the former communist areas, a lot of the former authoritarian leaders of the global south were running state-run systems. And that was when they introduced the market, it was actually very vulnerable to this kind of transactional oligarchic politics. So I do think there were elements of it in the military-industrial complex. And that's what actually worries me with Biden, because I think Biden will be beholden to a lot of corporate sponsors. So we're not going to have plain sailing, even if Biden wins. But going back to your general point, I think you're absolutely right in your analysis of Trump. And as you know, our friend Shalini Randhira, the anthropologist, says that contemporary populist authoritarianism consists of a combination of crony capitalism, ethnic nationalism, and toxic masculinity. And actually, that's exactly the combination that we observed in the Balkans, we observed it in Syria, all of the places that I study. And one of the things that makes me so alarmed about Trump is that, to me, he's eerily reminiscent of Milosevic in the early years. And also, you know, the armed gangs. In the case of Yugoslavia, they were factory workers who'd been thrown out of work as a result of IMF structural adjustment policies. They actually lived in the countryside and went into town to work in factories, and they'd lost their jobs, and it undermined their masculinity. And they were the people who engaged in massacres and ethnic cleansing.
That is a very stark note to end on, may I say?
Yeah, I know that really is quite a bleak point to end on.
Shall we say something positive about civil society?
Yeah, please do.
If you can think of anything.
Having said all that, contemporary wars are very fragmented, and there are large places where there are active civil society activists. And what you're seeing both in America and Britain, and maybe in other places, is a new generation of civic activists with Black Lives Matter, with the military alliance that we've talked about in China, who really have grown up with this and reject it totally. And, you know, I think the extent to which they can control certain local areas, which certainly will happen in America, there will be large parts of America that stay out of this, where they don't have the armed militias, where they do have people who control local authorities. They do have enough democracy at local level to reinvigorate things. And I think we're seeing the same thing in this country. So actually, if Biden wins, even though there are all these disturbing trends, there's a huge opportunity for global civil society, a huge opportunity for progressive local authorities to push different ways of doing things.
I think the other side of it is that Trump being quite as bad as he is and has been, has shocked like the American liberal center to the point where they are now talking about and committed, you know, to quite radical democratic change in the United States. So Biden won't rule out using a Senate majority to appoint two further liberal judges to rebalance the Supreme Court away from the far right. And I think there's quite a good chance that if he has the Senate majority to do it, he will do it. But perhaps more importantly still, they're talking about statehood for Puerto Rico, which is, you know, one of these great injustices, America's lost colony essentially, because it doesn't have statehood rights. So that would bring two further senators into the Senate and statehood for the District of Columbia too. So there is an opportunity to kind of permanently, through using simple democratic measures, right? I mean, the American Senate is a very peculiar structure anyway, because it's not based on the population of individual states. All states are represented in the same way, so it exaggerates the political power of the smaller states. So just through simple democratic measures, it will make it much harder for the hard right of the Republican Party to prosper successfully in the future. So it does feel like a real tipping point where if Biden does win, lots of the new thinking around radical democratic rethinking of globalization, as you described, Mary, could happen and could have the constitutional basis to happen too.
And also, if I could add to that, you know, I do think Trump has alienated the armed services and the security services.
Yes.
So unlike Milosevic or Assad in Syria, who controlled those things, Trump doesn't control them and Biden will. So that will make a very big difference and add to that opportunity. I also think we should think, I mean, thank God the EU has developed this recovery plan. Biden is going to do a huge investment in renewable energy. And actually, I think once we start real serious climate change policies, that is actually going to solve the problem of prosperity. I think it will have a kind of rock on effect and we'll suddenly go into a new golden age of economic growth, and that will make a big difference.
Great. There we go. Optimistic endpoint. Thanks so much for coming on, Mary. It's been really great to chat.
Brilliant. I wondered if I was too complicated with all that stuff at the beginning.
No, it was really good.
Fascinating. I really thought it was good, and I've got a super short attention span.
It wasn't too complicated, but it was learned.